Campus FM jippreżenta lecture organizzata mill-Istitut Agostinjan bis-suġġett Augustine on Marriage and Sexuality and the Pelagian Controversy. Il-kellim huwa Dr. Anthony Dupont.
Well, good evening. Introducing Dr. Anthony Dupont about his academic ether. You have the handout, but you have to add a couple of others what he hides from us. So, well, the photo has nothing to do with the lecture, I was told to. Dr. Anthony Dupont is, well, we met a couple of years back now, and it's the fourth time he's in Malta. The photo, you see the picture you see above on the left-hand side is when he actually presented Professor Oliari, a great scholar on Pelagianism, and Anthony is another authority on Pelagianism. Well, tonight he will discuss with us a text, the third book of Contra Julianum, against which also Augustine rebutted, and we shall see his the outcome of this debate. So I leave the floor to you, Andrew. Thank you.
Good evening. First of all, I would like to thank Father Salvino, Father Pierre, and all the members and assistants of the Augustinian Historical Institute to invite me to speak for you. Secondly, Father Salvino asked me to deal with one of the most delicate issues in Augustine's thinking, which undoubtedly will raise several questions. For this, I invite you to have some patience. First, we will listen to what Augustine wrote and taught, and then afterwards, we can exchange some opinions and questions. Thirdly, Father Salvino was so kind to distribute a handout. On the first page, you can probably see the reason why he invited me to deal with this topic, as I'm a young expert in marriage. I married last year. The second two pages are a summary of Father Salvino of the Pelagian controversy, and that's the historical background against which I will speak today. And then pages 5 and 6 are a handout with a summary step by step of the lecture, the paper I will deliver today. Augustine's teaching on marriage and sexuality has exerted a major influence on the development of Western Christian thought. His own view of marriage and of human sexuality developed over time. It was above all during and because of the Pelagian controversy, more specifically in his debate with Julian of Eclanum, the so-called second phase of the Pelagian controversy, that he systematically expounded and finalized his ideas on these issues. That is why today, here, we will examine Augustine's point of view in his debate with Julian. More in particular, we will focus on one of Augustine's writings on sexuality and marriage, which featured in this discussion with Julian in the Pelagian controversy. The third chapter, the third book of the writing Contra Julianum of Augustine. In order to better understand this writing of Augustine Contra Julianum, the work will be placed in its historical, contextual, and moral theological context before we commence its actual reading. We will then allow Augustine's ideas to be heard, and we will follow the structure of his text, of the third book of Contra Julianum. After having presented Augustine's line of reasoning, his arguments will then be thematically summarized and evaluated. First, situating Contra Julianum historically, theologically, intrinsically. About the year 421, Augustine wrote the work Contra Julianum, which consists of 6 books. What the title already suggests, contra Julianum, against Julian. The most important task in setting this work in its historical context is to identify its place in the debate between Augustine and Julian of Eclanum, and more generally, in the Pelagian controversy. In short, Pelagianism was a Christian movement, actually a kind of heretical theological tenet, called after Pelagius. This Pelagianism has his own specific theological ideas, particularly on the capacities of the human free will to lead the good life by one's own strength after baptism. So after baptism, one can achieve good Christian life without the grace of God. Pelagianism also very strongly holds to the non-existence of a non-personal sin such as original sin. So Pelagianism refutes the position defended by Augustine of original sin. I will expound on that later on. The Catholic North African theologians, fervently led by Augustine, reacted fiercely against disbeliefs in all sorts of discussions. Julian of Eclanum, Bishop of Beneventum in Italy, son of Bishop Memorius, and married to Titia, and Titia was probably the daughter of the Bishop of Beneventum, well, that Julian of Eclanum entered the Pelagian controversy when he refused to sign the letter of condemnation of Pelagius, promulgated by Pope Zosimus in 418. So the Pope condemned Pelagius and asked his bishops to sign that condemnation letter, and Julian of Eclanum refused to sign that condemnation of Pelagius. Julian refused to accept the existence of a non-personal, generally human sin inherited from Adam. This Pelagian debate also had repercussions in the domain of conjugal and sexual ethics, the topic of today. Augustine was convinced that original sin was passed on from generation to generation through via human sexuality, and Julian opposes this standpoint. In the third book of Augustine's Contra Julianum, the battle between Augustine and Julian erupts with great vehemence and on all fronts over the topic of marriage and sexuality. And that third book we will read later on. The historical context of Contra Julianum is the Pelagian controversy, especially the debate between Augustine and Julian, with at its heart marriage and sexuality. Before reading Augustine's defense in Contra Julianum against the accusations of Julian, it is necessary to briefly sketch the views of Julian on these two related topics. One can only understand the reaction if one knows against what this reaction is aimed at. Augustine's view of original sin and the sinfulness of sexual desire are, according to Julian, of Manichaean origin and therefore have to be condemned. By contrast, Julian states that sexual desire, like death, sickness for that matter, is natural and therefore not a consequence of original sin. So, at the forefront of their dispute on sexuality and marriage is their conflicting ideas over original sin. Julian opposes Augustine's view of tradux peccati, the transmission of Adam's sin to all his descendants, to all of mankind. And Julian tries to refute this. Julian realized that Augustine's conviction that since the fall, the whole of mankind is sinful, was connected to his view that sinfulness always manifests itself in sexual impulses. Consequently, when Julian wants to prove that Augustine's doctrine of original sin is faulty, he will also have to formulate an alternative in the domain of sexuality. Julian posits that sexual passion is not sinful, but innocent, necessary, and instinctive, seeing that God created it within us. Julian says that since God is a good creator, and God has created concupiscentia, concupiscentia meaning sexual lust, sexual desire, sexual passion, since God created that, logically, it has to be good. To substantiate this thesis, Julian falls back on a scientific and medical theory of his time, the calor genitalis. Procreation, according to Julian, is only possible through pleasure. How can sexual desire, sexual pleasure, be bad if it is a necessary means to achieve God's willed purpose of marriage, an institution established by God? Furthermore, Julian argues, sexuality is subordinate to the will. Concupiscentia, so sexual desire, is, according to Julian, not capable of terrorizing man. This means, according to Julian, that sexuality is only sinful if man chooses to misuse it by falling into excesses. Therefore, sexuality is not per se bad. Furthermore, Julian continues, all those who, like Augustine, consider concupiscentia as uncontrollable question human freedom and human responsibility. Julian remarks that if man, among other things, through sexuality, is always necessary sinful, virtuousness, leading a good ethical life, becomes impossible. All this shows that Julian was someone who was positive towards sexuality. Note that he does not propagate and praise promiscuity and licentious sexuality. In his own life, Julian was a postmarital celibate. He was married but remained celibatarian within his marriage. His positive attitude was prompted by his theoretical, theological, and anthropological position, which he defended against Augustine. Sometimes reference is made to a biographical difference between Augustine and Julian, which, it is claimed, could be at the root of their differing views on sexuality. From the Confessiones, the Confessions, Augustine appears to be a person heavily tormented by his sexual desire. His struggle against desire as a young man seemed to him of crucial importance. Hence, perhaps his view that sexuality is sinful and disobedient to the will. Julian came from a Christian aristocratic milieu where a virtuous ascetic life was the most important purpose in life. In this rather elitist Christian environment, sexuality was considered a controllable mean, and sexual needs apparently could be easily overcome. Sexuality, in that aristocratic milieu, was useful to guarantee offspring. Once that offspring was there, sexuality was no longer needed. Abstinence in marriage was then an obvious choice. Apparently, sexuality was obedient to the will after all, according to the existing views and customs within the aristocratic milieu. Moreover, sexual desire was of no major concern to the young aristocrats. Social standing, prestige, pressure from parents, and the like were their chief preoccupations. Another biographical element which to a certain extent could explain the fierceness of the debate is the risk both parties took. Julian moved in high ecclesial and imperial circles, and there he found a willing ear. By pretending as if he was ringing the alarm bell by warning that Augustine's ideas went too far and were a threat to the status of all married Christians, he put Augustine in a bad light. This carries two consequences. Julian defends Pelagius. If the leader of the movement against Pelagius, Augustine, himself does not seem to be entirely orthodox, then the sentence of Pelagius would become doubtful, and it could even be reversed. In that case, Augustine could forget about the universal condemnation of Pelagius. Should Pelagius be rehabilitated, Augustine himself, his biggest opponent, would run the risk of being condemned himself. The other side of the coin is that Julian too risked a lot. It could cost him his career, which it did, by opposing as a young bishop a great authority such as Augustine. Maybe also the difference in age played a role. The young, unbridled Julian against the older, composed Augustine. Augustine, who was above anything else, worried that a new controversy, a new schism, would divide Christianity, as a Donatist controversy has done in a violent way in his youth, and in which he, as a young bishop, had labored to heal this rift. So the stakes were very high. For the sake of completeness, I will give a short summary of Augustine's ideas on marriage and sexuality before the high point of the Pelagian controversy, which we will see in our reading of Contra Julianum. In his early writings, Augustine, writings like the Confessiones and the Soliloquia, Augustine does not treat the subject matter systematically. His early conviction was rather unfavorable. Sexuality and marriage distract us. They keep us from the speculative aspirations of a Christian philosopher. As the young bishop elaborately describes in his Confessiones, he considered conversion to Christianity to be a conversion to a celibate life, which was for a long period one of his biggest obstacles in his conversion. In the Confessions, he describes sexuality as mud, as a disease, which can only be overcome by God. In a further stage, Manichaeism, which opposes the heavenly, the good, the light, versus everything that's earthly, material. So Manichaeism opposes or rejects everything what is bodily, everything what is material, as by definition being bad. Now, Manichaeism forces him to reflect deeper on this issue. Manichaeists, in their dualistic aversion of everything that's bodily, everything that's earthly, everything that's material, well, Manichaeists reject sexuality and marriage as devilish, as the work of the devil. Augustine, by contrast, in his anti-Manichaean works, will prove that marriage is not the work of the devil, but is instituted by God. The next phase in Augustine's thinking on marriage and sexuality is marked by his answer to the thesis of the theologian Jovinian. Jovinian stated that marriage and celibacy are of equal merit. Augustine does not agree with this. He substantiates in his writing De Sancta Virginitate, on the Holy Virginity, that celibacy is superior to marriage. This, however, does not detract from the true goodness of marriage, because Augustine at the same time does not agree with the disdain of some ascetics of his time, amongst others, like Jerome, who disdained marriage and state that salvation is only possible by celibacy. Well, no, Augustine reacts in a tractate called De Bono Conjugali on the goodness of marriage, and he explains in that tractate that marriage is good in a threefold way. And in Latin, he calls that proles fides sacramentum. Marriage is good because it is aimed at procreation within a faithful marriage as a holy symbol of unity among God's people. Because of this last good, it's a sacrament, as a sign of unity, marriage, according to the Bishop of Hippo, is unbreakable. The purpose of marriage is procreation. It confirms and encourages mutual faith, and it is a sacrament, a holy symbol of unity amongst God's people. The next phase in Augustine's reflection on conjugal ethics we arrive at now, well, this is the phase of the Pelagian controversy, and that we will read in Augustine's Contra Julianum. In our discussion of the third book of Contra Julianum, we give the floor to Augustine. We will follow his line of argument, we follow his words. In the third book of Contra Julianum, Augustine reacts against Julian's attacks on his thinking concerning conjugal ethics and sexuality. Julian thinks that Augustine contradicts himself. On the one hand, Julian says that Augustine says, he posits that creation is good because originating with God, and on the other hand, he upholds that man, also a creature, at birth, is already within the power of the devil through original sin. This is how Julian represents Augustine. Augustine replies that this is not contradictory. According to him, Julian fails to understand that before the salvation by Christ, mankind is indeed subjected to the devil by original sin, but in such a way that neither man nor the devil can get away from the power of God. So God is always the upper hand. Now it's Augustine's turn. He points out a contradiction, even a paradox, within his opponent's argument. Julian is against baptism of children, and yet at the same time he emphasizes the value of baptism as salvation. These two ideas are incompatible. Augustine makes a further remark. If baptism is a salvation from what then? Of original sin, of course, but this doctrine is denied by Julian. The theological rhetorical question, if baptism is a salvation, from what then are we delivered, will be a jingle in Augustine's response to Julian. Augustine argues, baptism is administered for the remission of sins. This is also the case for babies. Babies, however, do not have personal sin, and still they are baptized for the remission of sins. Thus, there has to be another sin in babies, Augustine argues. This is original sin. This implies, in Augustine's reasoning, that unbaptized babies who die cannot go to heaven because they are not completely innocent. They have original sin. Augustine develops an argument to demonstrate that children cannot be born free from sin, but that they are always contaminated with original sin. The basic principle is that God is just. The Pelagians do not realize that it is a severe punishment for a deceased unbaptized child, which is the image of God, to be eternally banished from God's kingdom, and that such a punishment would not be just unless the child was already subject to sin. God would not allow this if these children would be completely innocent. Since newborn babies cannot yet themselves have committed any sin, they must have inherited in some way or another a guilt, and this is original sin. Augustine, in this third book of Contra Julianum, first had to prove the truth of the doctrine of original sin. Only now he can refute Julian's accusations concerning the link between original sin and sexuality. "I do not say," Augustine writes, "that marriage sees to it that children fall under dominion of the devil, as Julian claims I do. According to the Bishop of Hippo, marriage has its own order and goodness which cannot be lost when committing sins." Julian wrongly states that Augustine puts forward that all sexuality is bad. Augustine defends himself in clear language. And this is the first quote of Contra Julianum, which is in the handout. And I take some sentences out of it. Augustine answers to Julian, "But I did not even find fault within the union of the two sexes, if it is lawful and within marriage. Without it, after all, there would be no generation of human beings, even if no one had first sinned." Augustine, "I do not say that the act which husband and wife perform for the sake of begetting children is evil. It is rather good because it makes good use of the evil of sexual desire." And now we are at the center. Sexual desire, which is in Latin concupiscentia carnis, here we arrive at the central point in Augustine's thinking. This concupiscentia carnis, sexual desire, is disturbed, is perverted by the first sin of Adam in paradise. That first sin of Adam in paradise, the fall, disturbed that desire, that concupiscentia. Already in the previous quotation, Julian's grave accusation of Augustine is apparent, a charge which will play a role throughout the book. Julian believes that Augustine thinks that the bodies of people are created by the devil. In other words, Julian suspects Augustine of Manichaeism. Nothing could be further removed from the truth, Augustine argues. He also believes that the bodies are created by God and therefore have to be good. Augustine is convinced that God has created two genders to make sexuality and the begetting of children possible. Insofar these things are created by God, they are consequently also good. However, they are not only good. At the same time, they are also bad. Bad not because they were created by God, but because they have been contaminated by original sin. These things are therefore not good in themselves. The badness does not originate from the sex differences, the difference between male and female, or the sexuality as such, but from primal sin. The discussion then becomes a little bit more technical. The concupiscentia carnis is, according to Julian, good, only the excesses are bad, because they are caused by a mistake of the will. The concupiscentia carnis seems to be controlled by the will and is therefore only sinful if the will chooses to sin, according to Julian. Augustine does not agree with the idea that this desire belongs to a fair decision of the will. The concupiscentia carnis is always already sinful. A decision by the will to sin or not is out of the question, for the will is not capable to decide of enforcing its will after Adam's fall. A married man cannot limit his lust to those moments when he needs this, and the idea that a celibate life can see to it that this lust will never trouble him is, according to Augustine, certainly not true. What they want, they cannot achieve. Although the will indeed battles against desire, it cannot master it. Augustine even adds a personal comment. Julian, if you believe sexuality to be so positive, why do you live in celibacy? Again, Julian, Augustine writes, I can catch you on a contradiction. You say that chastity in marriage is a way between sensuality and celibacy. You even use the words of the Apostle Paul, but if they cannot control themselves, let them marry. 1 Corinthians 7:9. Augustine, apparently you, Julian, recognize that a remedy is required for concupiscentia, and yet you protest when I declare that concupiscentia is a disease. If you acknowledge the remedy, then also acknowledge the disease. If you deny the disease, then you also must deny the remedy. Be consequent. Nobody provides a cure for somebody for something which is healthy. He catches Julian on his words. Julian states that sexual desire in marriage is exercised virtuously in marriage and is kept under control with celibacy. But you keep something under control, Augustine argues, only when that something is bad. The conclusion is therefore obvious, according to Augustine. What exactly Augustine understands marriage to mean, he formulates in the next paragraph, and this is the second quote on the handout. You, Julian, also state this point correctly. Marriage cannot be thoroughly pleasing if it is praised by comparison with something evil. This is true. In its class, marriage is altogether good, but it is good because it preserves the fidelity of the marriage bed, because it unites the sexes for the sake of having children, and because it stands in horror at the impiety of divorce. These are the goods of marriage which make marriage good. We have often said that they could have existed even if no one had sinned. So even if Adam did not fall in paradise. But after the first sin of Adam, there was added to marriage, not as a matter of happiness, but of necessity, a struggle so that by its goodness it too fights against the evil of concupiscence. It does not allow that evil to do anything forbidden, even though it never ceases to arouse one to such things, at times with weaker, at other times with stronger feelings, and it makes good use of its evil for the propagation of children. Who would deny that it is evil except someone who does not listen to the apostle's warning? I say this, however, as a concession, not as a command. 1 Corinthians 7:6. When married couples are overcome, not by the desire to have children, but by the desire to enjoy carnal pleasure and have intercourse, the apostle does not praise this, but excuses it in comparison with what is worse, because marriage intervenes and intercedes on their behalf. Summarized, marriage is in itself good. Augustine placed the goodness of marriage in three aspects: faithfulness of the two partners, procreation, and the aversion to divorce. Since the fall, marriage falls prey to concupiscentia. Marriage has constantly fight against the desire to have sexuality in an illegal way. This is purely out of lust and not in agreement with the three good aims of marriage. In the last sentence of the paragraph we just read, Augustine shows himself to be very moderate. While before he seemed to maintain that sexuality is only acceptable within marriage and only for the purpose of having children, here he seems to be less radical. Sexuality between a married couple without the intention of procreation is not a mortal sin. It can be forgiven. This sin is far less worse than sexuality without procreation outside marriage. In that case, it's only lust which prevails, and this is a mortal sin. The conclusion, therefore, is that also for Augustine, marriage is not bad. At the end of the third book, we encounter some conclusions. The marriage in which we are born is good. The evil against which we fight and which fight against us does neither originate from God nor from origin, nor from our marriage, but has a perverted origin, original sin. So the evil is not because it's created by God, marriage is instituted good by God, sexuality as such is also good within marriage. The evil lies in the desire, the wrongly oriented sexual desire, and that has its root in original sin. At birth, a human being is innocent personally, but at the same time already guilty as a descendant of Adam. Marriage itself did not bring forth concupiscentia, but it can be used in a good way. So marriage can be used in a good way. Julian bends a few of Augustine's statements to his will in order to claim that Augustine would maintain that before the primal sin, marriage was so different from the present marriage, so marriage in paradise before fall is different from marriage nowadays, according to Julian's reconstruction of Augustine's thinking, that initially it had no need of concupiscentia, no need of sexual movement, no need of the genders. Augustine denies this reconstruction of Julian. Augustine emphasizes that the only difference for him is that in the prelapsarian paradise, so in paradise before fall, there was no concupiscentia mala, there was no bad desire. Also, before the fall, there was sexuality directed towards procreation. At that time, before the fall, this was the result of a peaceful will which controlled the body, without there being any need for concupiscentia. Nowadays, after the fall, concupiscentia is needed. Concupiscentia, therefore, is a necessary, well-used evil. This sexual desire after the fall is anything but peaceful. The turbulent lust rages through the human body. So this was the third book of Augustine's Contra Julianum. After having heard Augustine himself, it's time now, as a kind of conclusion, to repeat briefly his arguments in a more thematic overview, so we come a little bit loose from the text, the order of his text, and I will add also elements taken from his other anti-Pelagian writings. The influence of the Pelagian controversy on Augustine's interpretation of marriage and sexuality is significant. It prompted Augustine to make the connection between original sin and sexual desire. Not only did their bodies as a punishment become subject to disease and death, Adam and Eve were also plagued by the same urge which incites animals to copulate. as a consequence of the fall, of which we all bear the consequences as original sin, all people are born with the same animal urge. This urge does what it wants, because it has detached itself from rational control of the human spirit and soul. That is the concupiscentia carnis mala, the bad fleshly desire. Ever since the first disobedience of Adam and Eve, humankind has been marked by original sin. Of these, death and sexual desire, which stand at the far ends of human life, the beginning and the end, are the preeminent signs of original sin. They do not belong to the original nature of creation. As a punishment, they have come into the world. At this moment, a first qualification is necessary. Augustine writes that sexual desire, although sinful, can be used good in marriage with a view to begetting children. He makes, in other words, the distinction between the evil of concupiscentia and the good of marriage. Even though, according to Augustine, sexual desire is sinful in itself, it can be legitimately practiced within the three goals of marriage: procreation, mutual faithfulness, and the sacrament of the unity between Christ and the Church. Between the argument that sexuality in certain cases is legitimate and therefore not sinful, something of great importance lays hidden: human freedom. If, on the one hand, sexuality can sometimes be legitimate, it can, on the other hand, sometimes in a non-legitimate way be exercised. In the first case, man is innocent because he has the right intention. Apparently, man can choose between sinning and not sinning. Julian is thus incorrect when he claims that for Augustine, man is unfree and always sinful. Sexual desire is a desire to sin, but it is not yet itself sin. It only becomes sin when man actively gives in to this desire. In this way, Augustine exonerates himself from Julian's charge that Augustine perceives marriage as such as bad, because he considers its instrument, sexual desire, to be contaminated ever since the fall. No, Augustine states, marriage as such is good and is not affected by the use of sexual passion to reach its goal. Sexual desire, legitimized by procreation, even receives among Christians a positive value. Through procreation, through sexuality, Christians beget children of God, spread the kingdom of God, and pass on Christ's salvation to their descendants, on the condition, of course, that these children receive baptism. Augustine shows for a second time, in another way, that marriage as such is not contaminated. In a letter to fellow Bishop Atticus of Constantinople, Augustine distinguishes concupiscentia nuptiarum from concupiscentia carnis. He makes a distinction between the desire for marriage and the desire for the flesh. Concupiscentia nuptiarum, the desire for marriage, for offspring, is not sinful. The concupiscentia carnis, the desire of the flesh or the desire for the flesh, however, is. Two things which are connected with each other and make up the core of Augustine's argument require further explanation now, namely what this fleshly desire consists of and why it is only from the fall onwards that it was considered a sin. Concupiscentia carnis, sexual desire, existed before the first human sin, in an innocent form with Adam and Eve. At that moment, this desire was completely in harmony with the will, subjected to the decisions of the will. Not only marriage is good, according to Augustine, originally even the concupiscentia was good, and in other words, certainly not created by the devil. As a punishment for the first sin, God weakened the human will, as a result of which, from that moment on, the sexual urges could escape the human will. So from that moment, human will is not in charge, not in control anymore of sexual desires. If Adam and Eve would not have sinned, mankind today would still have had that concupiscentia in its innocent form. However, since the fall, ever since, concupiscentia means stormy, disturbed longings which collide with our will. Concupiscentia carnis burdens us with an uncontrollability which time and again makes us gravitate towards the flesh. However, and this is the second explanation, the flesh does not coincide with the body as such. The flesh, the fleshly, represents everything which instigates us to place our own will above God's will. So the flesh is a kind of a symbol for each moment in which we want to take the place of God. This urge does not come from our body, but from our soul torn apart since the fall. Our will is no longer the absolute sovereign. Self-control is no longer evident. The lust, the desire of the flesh, has deprived mankind of its ability to devote itself completely to God alone. And for that, flesh, the fleshly, is a symbol. Sexual desire has completely withdrawn itself from the authority of the will. That is why, as Augustine kept hammering away in Contra Julianum, a medicine is required to curb this inclination to licentiousness, celibacy or chastity within marriage. When the issue of sexuality happens to come up in one of Augustine's non-Pelagian, non-polemical writings, then he has a sharp eye, for human reality. This he does, for example, in his sermons. In his audience, there were no doubt also married people. And in his sermons, he states, for instance, that sexuality between a married couple without an explicit child wish is but a small, a daily sin, of which one through daily prayer or the giving of alms could very easily receive absolution. Some final remarks. I will give two kinds of final remarks, first in general and then as an evaluation of the debate with Julian. In general, on the basis of Augustine's own story in the Confessiones, Augustine sometimes is in jest described as a poacher who turned into gamekeeper, someone who first led a promiscuous life and later on forbade everyone to have sex. This charge of promiscuity is, however, gravely exaggerated. He always remained faithful to his concubine. When his mother sent his concubine away to arrange a profitable marriage for her son, Augustine began a new short-lived relationship in anticipation of this marriage. As a result of these two relationships, which, as he describes himself, were sexual relationships, he elaborately describes how he, as a young man, could only renounce sexuality with much difficulty. He considered abstinence and celibacy the best way to be a Christian, but he thought it extremely difficult to reach this ideal. As a young man, he felt himself dominated, enslaved even, by concupiscentia carnis. More generally, it has often been claimed that the negative attitude of Christianity and of the Catholic Church towards sexuality is rooted in Augustine's approach of sexuality. A historical critical analysis shows, however, that this is an exaggerated interpretation again. Augustine himself reacts against the position propagated, for instance, by Jerome, that celibacy is the only acceptable way of life and that all sexuality in any case is sinful, even within marriage. Augustine completely disagrees with this depreciation of marriage. Next to celibacy, there is the Christian marital status. Within marriage, and within marriage alone, sexuality is accepted if it is with a view to procreation, as an expression of mutual faithfulness and conceived as a sacrament of unity. In other words, Augustine does not use or conceive of sexuality by definition as negative, as many of his contemporaries did. Yet, we have to admit, in this matter, he is much stricter than current Christian and Catholic conjugal ethics. He reduces sexuality effectively to the begetting of children, and not as something valuable in itself within Christian marriage. He states that sexuality can be used to the good, but sexuality alone, as such, he values rather negatively. This negative interpretation of sexuality, as I explained the past hour, is prompted by his understanding of original sin. Theologically, he considers sexuality to be corrupted by the fall of Adam. Augustine accepts marriage as a good, but in the end he considers celibacy to be more highly principled. He actually also prefers a spiritual interpretation of marriage. Once the desire to have children is fulfilled, he recommends that married couples abstain from sexuality. But if partners have difficulties with this abstinence, he allows them sexuality. Seeing that this sexuality is not directed towards procreation, he considers this to be a sin, but a small daily sin, which is aimed at preventing one of the partners from committing adultery, which would be a mortal sin. So in general, our conclusion is that Augustine approaches sexuality more positively than many of his rigorous contemporaries, and as in many representations of Augustine, even today. His analysis that sexuality is not just a neutral given, but that it can encroach deeply in human life, psychologically and emotionally, is a fact that we also accept today. Many existing prejudices concerning Augustine's view on sexuality have to be qualified and to be put in context. On the other hand, we also have to admit that Augustine, in general, certainly compared to our contemporary attitudes and within the framework of the Church's teaching on conjugal ethics, is rather negative in his view of sexuality and marriage. Second, final remark, which is the final remark, a small evaluation of the debate between Augustine and Julian. First of all, we have to conclude that Augustine is not as negative as Julian claims. Firstly, Augustine distinguishes marriage, which in itself is good and has three good purposes, from the negative interpretation of sexual desire. Secondly, the Bishop of Hippo considers even concupiscentia not as purely negative, and sexual concupiscentia can furthermore be used positively, in particular for the benefit of the good of marriage. In short, marriage is good, procreation has been instituted by God, and concupiscentia, as well as everything that pertains our body, do not necessarily have to be interpreted negatively. So Julian is wrong in depicting Augustine in this negative way. What is clear, however, is that the concupiscentia carnis after the fall of Adam is negative and is a negative consequence of the fall. Even though Augustine rightly argues that his view on sexuality and marriage is not as negative as Julian wants us to believe, sexuality between a married couple with the explicit desire to have children is the only thing, in the end, which he considers to be acceptable. For sexuality within a marriage, without the immediate desire to beget children, he is prepared to make a small exception. Although it is a sin, the sin is not too big and it can be forgiven. All in all, sexuality is, with the exception of procreation, according to Augustine, not the essence of a good Christian marriage. For this reason, from our modern outlook on marriage and sexuality, Augustine seems to hold a harsh position which we can hardly understand, or which we find difficult to understand. However, we should not forget that Augustine is defending his position within a polemic. In a polemical conflict, one has to defend oneself, and we saw that the stakes were very high. This is done, if one defends oneself in a polemical situation, one defends oneself by positing one's own position as clearly as possible. To that end, and because of this, one often falls back into extremes and black and white positions. A gray area can therefore not exist. So the logic within Augustine's thinking in the controversy, because he wanted to remain as a very logic and systematic thinker, brought him to these conclusions. Perhaps when that polemic would not have been so hard, his conclusions could have perhaps been different, because we see that his pastoral practice is more moderate. In a polemical situation, there is no room for nuances and qualification. When Augustine busies himself with marriage and sexuality, it is almost exclusively within anti-Pelagian and therefore strongly polemical writings. This could maybe explain his extreme point of view, an extreme point of view which, by the way, even today is not accepted by the Catholic ethical moral teaching. When the pastor Augustine gets up to speak in a sermon, he appears to be moderate and humane, reconciling, forgiving, certainly within the Christian outlook of his time on marriage and sexuality, so compared with the thinking of his contemporaries. As a pastor, he strives to safeguard the treasure of authentic Christian married life. He warns for the pitfalls of an unbridled sexual desire, which he experienced himself in his youth, and which we regrettably see everywhere around us in our contemporary society. As a theologian, he orients his flock and us to an ideal. And as a pastor, he is ready to accept the imperfect human attempts to reach this ideal. Also, in this context, we should remember his famous saying, Dilige et fac quod vis. Love, love first in the right, correct way, within the love for God, and then act. And then act within a good, authentic, married life. Thank you.
Għadkom kem smajtu lecture organizzata mill-Istitut Agostinian bis-sujġett Augustine on Marriage and Sexuality and the Pelagian Controversy. Il-kellim kien Dr. Anthony Dupont.